So, Joshua, what does the title Moonwalking with Einstein refer to?
Moonwalking with Einstein refers to a memory device that I use when I competed in the United States Memory Championship in 2006. It was the way I learned how to memorize a deck of playing cards.
And what is Einstein doing, and why is he moonwalking?
Well, I represented the Four of Spades. Moonwalking was the King of Hearts, and Einstein was the Three of Diamonds in my imagination. I should explain, I suppose we should go back and I should explain why in the world I would have been memorizing a deck of playing cards.
Sure, go ahead.
There is this strange contest held every spring in New York City called the United States Memory Championship. And I had gone there to cover it as a science journalist, I guess thinking it was going to be like the Super Bowl of savants or something, that it would be these guys with photographic memories, freaks of nature, because I'd read that they were able to memorize entire poems and hundreds of random numbers.
Right.
Turns out that wasn't the case. These individuals had actually trained themselves to perform these rather incredible mental gymnastics, and I ended up spending the better part of the next year training my own memory to do this and coming back and competing sort of as an exercise in participatory journalism the following year. And that was when I used that mnemonic of moonwalking with Einstein to remember a deck of playing cards in that contest.
So that's what got you interested in the subject of memorizing and memory and things like that in the first place.
Yeah, you know, I went to this contest. I saw these individuals who claimed to have average memories reeling off strings of 300 random digits and all sorts of stuff. It was just mind-blowing. And I realized I didn't know the first thing about how my memory worked. I couldn't comprehend what they were doing. And that sort of set me on this journey, not only to train my memory, but to investigate it and try and figure out a little bit about how it works and why it sometimes doesn't work.
So you went through the process of training yourself. You said these aren't people who are necessarily magically, naturally gifted or have photographic memories and can just see a number or a book page that they saw, but they actually train, they exercise their brain muscles.
Yeah, so and I was totally skeptical when these individuals told me that. They call themselves mental athletes, by the way, the people who compete in these contests. A few years back, some rather well-known psychologists in London brought a bunch of these memory champions into the lab and essentially wanted to suss out whether they were being honest when they said they had just average memories, and put them in an MRI and found that actually structurally, anatomically, there was nothing unusual about their brains. General cognitive tests, they were pretty much average, but when they did fMRI scans, while they were actually memorizing random numbers and all sorts of other stuff, they found that these mental athletes were engaging different regions of the brain from control subjects when they were memorizing. Namely, they were activating regions of the brain associated with spatial memory, which is fascinating. Why would they be doing that?
Sure, spatial, right.
It turns out they were using a set of techniques that were invented 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece, supposedly according to legend by the poet Simonides. And those techniques involve essentially transforming things that we are not very good at remembering, like random numbers, into vivid visual images that are then placed in a building, which is called a memory palace.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what these mental athletes, memory champions, were doing. They were walking around this imagined architecture in their brains while they were memorizing.
The house of memory.
Yeah, a house of memory, exactly.
Basically, it was just a matter of they were training to do a certain skill. I noted in your book that they spoke disparagingly of the concept of photographic memory.
Photographic memory appears to be a myth. There is one case in the literature, a woman with a photographic memory, paper published in 1970 in the journal Nature, which is the most
reputable journals
in the world, and has never been replicated. They actually, scientists after that paper came out, put out calls in newspapers all over the world for, if you have a photographic memory, call us. And when they brought in those individuals into the lab and tested them, none of them could perform this nifty trick of essentially taking a picture with their mind's eye and recalling it with perfect fidelity.
And you mentioned in the book, she was never tested on again because she ended up marrying the fellow who tested her.
Well, it's a quirky story, and I think there are a lot of psychologists who now have doubts about whether this is actually a real phenomenon.
Sure. Do you remember everything that you had to remember for the competition, or have you forgotten that?
Oh, my gosh. Forgotten. Absolutely. I mean, one of the funny things about these competitions is your goal is merely to remember this information long enough to recall it in the contest, and then you actually willfully want to forget it. And the reason is, in one of these contests, you're storing your memories in one of these mental memory palaces. And unless you're one of the best guys in the world, you don't have enough memory palaces to actually last you from competition to competition. You have to reuse them. And reusing them means essentially wiping them of the memories that you formed in the previous competition. So they have strategies, mental athletes have strategies to walk through their memory palaces, erasing memories, which I think is kind of a beautiful, strange idea.
It's kind of like the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, erasing your own memories.
Yeah.
There's actually, I think, just one figure in your book, a graph of what you call the curve of forgetting, which is a little different than willful forgetting. What is that exactly?
Well, that's the experience we all know, which is that when you learn something, you start forgetting it almost the second after you learn it. And that forgetting follows a rather natural curve, where if you retest somebody on something they've learned an hour later, 2 hours later, a day later, a week later, you'll see that they remember less and less. That's what we're all up against. And these mental athletes have one strategy for combating the curve of forgetting, which is that they use these memory techniques.
I liked the line in your book that said that once upon a time, there was nothing to do with thoughts except to remember them. There was no alphabet to transcribe them in, no books, no way to write down anything. So anything that you needed to remember, you had to consciously remember. Any idea, information you wanted to transmit, you had to remember it. It seems obvious, but in the context, it seemed very evocative. For much of the history of humans, that was the case. But now we've effectively outsourced our memories, starting with writing and books and libraries, and now with digital media. What do you think are the individual and cultural pros and cons of this evolution of memory?
Well, the pros are pretty clear. I mean, it is much handier to be able to consult a book upon a shelf as opposed to having to have had that book essentially memorized or that text memorized if you wanted to consult it. And I find my GPS is much handier at remembering directions than my mind. But I think that there's been something that we've lost in the process of, as you say, outsourcing our memories to these external technologies. And I do use the word technology in the broadest possible sense to encapsulate everything from the alphabet to the BlackBerry.
Sure.
One of the consequences is that we no longer trust our memories. We see every little thing that we forget as evidence that they're failing us altogether, that we're losing it. When, in fact, what I learned firsthand through the process of researching this book and doing this training that was really quite elaborate is that there's more potential in there than we give our minds credit for. Our memories are actually pretty good. We just don't really believe it.
You give several studies in the books showing people that their memories are actually sometimes better than they think they are, that even though they think, oh, I can never remember those 30 or 1,000 different pictures, there are tests to show that actually your brain does remember them. It's just the trick of being able to recall them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a famous study that was conducted in the 70s where they actually showed people 10,000 pictures. And they let them look at them for 5 seconds each. It took an entire week, basically, to perform the test. And then they went back and tested them, where they showed them one picture they'd seen before and one picture they hadn't. And their ability to recognize the one they'd seen before, even though it was 10,000 pictures that they'd just looked at once, was astounding. They remembered over 80%, recognized over 80% of the photos.
That's amazing.
And that points to something that is, if you think about it, kind of obvious, which is that our memories are actually pretty good. Like, we remember an awful lot.
We just don't trust
them. We happen to focus on the little things that we don't remember, but our memories are better than we give them credit for.
Talking about outsourcing and depending on external technology for our memories, what impact do you think this end of remembering has on education or other cultural aspects.
These days, memory is almost a bad word in education.
The idea of rote learning is always spoken disparagingly.
Right, and rightfully so. We've spent a century reforming our education system to make learning not only more fun, but to essentially produce individuals who are hopefully abstract thinkers and creative thinkers and people who can have new ideas. But in the process, we've de-emphasized the notion of raw knowledge. And if you look at what kids graduate from high school today not knowing really basic stuff like, you know, when the U.S. Civil War was within 50 years or who we fought against in World War II, it's actually pretty important stuff for citizens to know if we're going to have good citizens. And I would argue, you know, our views on education swing like a pendulum. I think we've probably de-emphasized memory and information a little bit too much. It wouldn't surprise me if in the years to come the pendulum swings back a little bit in that direction.
Well, how would you answer to someone who says, well, why do I need to just memorize facts? I can just look them up anytime I want.
That's right. You can Google them. It's a perfectly good argument. What I would say in response is Google can't create a new thought. You have to have stuff knocking around in your skull if you're going to move through the world finding it interesting, making new connections, seeing things in new ways. Our memories are not just some vault that we dip into and pull stuff out of when we need them. Our memories are always there shaping our perceptions, shaping how we move through the world, the decisions we end up making in it. You can't neglect that. They're the essence of who we are and how we think.
Exercising your memory, still keeping that up, it even has larger political or cultural impacts in how the people think and consider information that they take in.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't want to overstate the case, but I do think that there is a cost to our essentially neglecting this most essential human capacity.
Have you found that there's any correlation between people with who are good at memorizing things and what you would consider as people who are smart? Is there kind of a relationship between people remembering a lot of facts and being able to process and analyze those facts?
I actually think there is. I think there's a feedback process there. You know, when we remember stuff, and now I'm not speaking of these esoteric competitions and memorizing hundreds of numbers. I'm talking about real everyday memory. When we remember stuff, we're doing it because, or we find things memorable because we're able to integrate them into a network of other things that we know. I was in China not long ago, walking around Shanghai. I realized, I had gone through high school not learning the first thing about China. I'm sure that would be different if I went to high school today. And it wasn't just I didn't know stuff. I couldn't learn new things about China because I didn't have the basic facts to fasten other facts too.
So it gives you a framework.
It's hard to be a curious person walking around China because I didn't know what the difference between Qing and Ming was, you know, which dynasty was when. You need that if you're going to move through the world appreciating and learning.
So it gives you something to latch information onto and find relationships.
Right, and it's like a spider web that grows as it captures more information, right? The more we know, the easier it is to know more. And I think that's part of the reason that so many of the people that I regard as being really intelligent people have wonderful memories. It's not always a perfect correlation. There's certainly forgetful old professors who are brilliant, and I definitely spent time with savants who remembered a ton but couldn't process it in any way. But the general principle that I think our memories are related to some level of intelligence, I buy into that.
How does memory affect what you might call our sense of self?
I would answer that question, I think, with a story. I had a chance in the process of researching this book to spend time with an individual named E.P., how he's known in the literature. He's subsequently passed away, unfortunately. But E.P. had what was probably the worst memory in the world. He was an amnesiac whose brain was struck by a freakish virus that essentially cored it like an apple, destroyed his hippocampal regions, which are the part of the brain that transform our perceptions into long-term memories. Without a memory, he had forgotten everything that had happened essentially since 1950 and was unable to form new memories. Without a memory, he had become this kind of hollow self. a person needs to exist in the dimension of time to be a person. He couldn't provide even the most basic psychological sustenance to his friends and family because he couldn't remember anything more recent than his most recent thought.
He had no memories to be able to create a timeline.
That's right. That's right. And spending time with him, I really appreciated the extent to which our memories make us who we are. I mean, you could have a conversation with EP, and it would take maybe a few minutes before you realize that there was something deeply wrong. But once you realized it, it was profound. This was someone who was operating in a completely different kind of existence.
What about the flip side? What about false memories? You know, we all have these times when we're absolutely sure we remember something that actually didn't happen. How is that related?
One of the things that happens to our memories over time is that they can change, that they can mutate. And that's actually something I gather happens at the neurological level. As we recall memories, they have a habit of mutating, of shifting, of changing. It's strange, but apparently true.
What kind of professions do you find people with good memory tend to do well in, or have you even looked at that?
It's not something I looked at, but I'll tell you, one of the people I write about in the book is a guy named S, who was studied in the 1930s by the psychologist A.R. Luria. And S was supposedly able to remember almost everything.
He was the one who, his memory palace instead was a street that he walked down in Moscow,
oh,
I believe.
He had many,
right?
many memory palaces. There were hundreds of them, thousands of them, no doubt. But he did seem to use a technique like the memory palace. And S was essentially non-functional. He remembered too much. And he couldn't make that distinction between the things that were trivial and not worth remembering and the things that were worth remembering. And as a result, he really couldn't hold down a job. He couldn't make sense of most things that he read. Certainly anything that was abstract, like poetry, just was really difficult for him. And ultimately, he sort of made his living as a memory sideshow act. That was kind of all he could do.
Are there tricks to being able to forget things? You know, there are certainly cases where people have experiences they would like to forget.
So S, supposedly, in the rather lyrical recounting of his story by Luria, which I write about in Moonwalking with Einstein, S realized that he had to learn an art of forgetting. The art of memory came naturally to him. It was the art of forgetting that he needed to learn. And he tried. He would try burning up in his mind's eye these images of things that he wanted to forget. And that didn't work because he still saw the images floating above the embers in his mind's eye. Eventually, the realization he had was that all he had to do to forget was tell himself, let himself feel that he didn't need to remember these things. And once he told himself that, he could start forgetting. It's beautiful, it's poignant, but I don't know how applicable it is to the rest of us who don't walk around remembering everything.
It is nice to think about it that way. You're right, it's poignant. He basically gave himself permission to forget.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that you're done with the competition and have written this book, do you find that you try to remember things still, or do you take notes and rely on your outsourced technology to keep track of your schedule like the rest of us?
I do. I confess to typing phone numbers into my cell phone and writing down my schedule. But I will say that I do try and keep in shape a little bit, even though I hung up my cleats several years ago. I will remember my shopping list when I go to the grocery store, just to make sure that I'm keeping my skills up.
So you don't go to the memory gym every day, but you may go out for a short run.
Exactly. And I'm developing a mnemonic potbelly, you might say.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you.